Right, this is actually lesson 25, and we are still in our series dealing with Christianity in Africa, although I probably should change that because we're kind of moving out of Africa up into the Roman Empire on the north side of the Mediterranean. But this is actually part 8 of Christianity in Africa. It was 7 weeks ago that we began this series. We've discussed a lot of places. We've discussed some influential people. We've noted a couple of very important controversies that took place during the days of Cyprian when he was in Carthage. We noted persecution that took place under Decius and Valerian. Last week, we turned our attention to an area in the Mideast, and we discussed the fact that it was at the turn of the 4th century, very early in the 4th century, that Armenia actually took on as Christianity as its national religion. It was the first country to take Christianity as its national religion. That was due to the evangelistic efforts of an individual we described last week as Gregory the Illuminator, and he was able to evangelize those people, evangelize the emperor of that kingdom, king of that kingdom, and became technically the first Christian nation. We reflected on several significant reintroductions of some pagan worship that took place, some false religions. We talked about sun worship that was reintroduced, which is just simply old paganism. We introduced Neoplatonism, which is simply Greek philosophy that they took on. And then Manichaeism, which is just a new form of Gnosticism. We talked about all three of those last week. And for the remainder of our time last week, we turned our attention to some of the hardships, some of the adversities that were faced by the church during the latter days of the 3rd century and then early in the 4th century. We talked about the new emperor Diocletian who took over. Diocletian took over in AD 284, and he was desirous, we want to hope benevolently, desirous to bring unity to the empire. And so rather than have the empire run by one emperor himself, Diocletian, he decided to divide the empire into two, into the east and into the west. So doing that, he had two rulers over each half. You had what they called an Augustus, which would be the senior ruler, and then a Caesar under that ruler, and that would be a junior ruler. So you had two in the east, two in the west. And he was the emperor in the east, the Augustus in the east. He basically ruled it by way of tetrarchy. Right? He had ruled by four. That lasted, and last week I said it lasted about a decade, but technically it lasted around 40 years is about how long that lasted. But it had fractures very, very early. Because I'll describe some of these. Like, for example, in the east, Diocletian was the Augustus, the senior ruler. His Caesar in the east was a man by the name of Galerius. Galerius was strongly anti-Christian. He was severely persecuting Christians. Diocletian was at least tolerant of them. He did not want to give out persecution of the Christians until later on he was influenced by Galerius to do so. In the west, the man who was the senior ruler over there was a man by the name of Maximius, and his Caesar, the second man under him, was a man named Constantius. Constantius was the father of Constantine. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Constantius was tolerant of Christians, but Maximius was not. Maximius was very strongly persecuting Christians. So in the east and in the west, you had two diametrically opposed rulers ruling over. So you can just see the fractions and the schisms that would take place and how it was just really, really fractured from the very beginning. It was in AD 303, so now we're moving just right into the 4th century, when Diocletian was influenced by Galerius to take up severe persecutions against the Christians. So we've come almost 20 years. He started in 284, divided up the empire. Now we're at AD 303. So we've come close to two decades. And this would be the final, most intense persecution that the Christians would experience under official rule of the Roman Empire. It was the last and the most severe. Diocletian, under the influence of Galerius, issued four edicts against Christianity. Edict number one was the key targets of this piece of legislation were senior Christian clerics, Christians' property. The edict prohibited Christians from assembling for worship and ordered the destruction of their scriptures, ordered the destruction of their liturgical books, and placed and also destroyed the places of worship in the empire. So they just went out throughout the empire, all the officials, just taking Christians captive, taking their properties, destroying their places of worship, throwing them into prisons, throwing them into a mine to work and to labor until they died. So that was what was taking place in the East under Diocletian. Edict number two was an order to arrest and imprison all the bishops and all the preachers, all the priests, they call them the priests. Edict number three, so now you've got all these imprisoned, and we talked a little bit about that, but what took place last week. Edict number three, there was a general amnesty, but any imprisoned clergyman could be freed under this amnesty as long as he agreed to make a sacrifice to gods, the Roman gods. Well, you know, some did. Some lapsed in their faith. Some did not. And many of them died for their faith. They were beheaded. Most of them were beheaded. Finally, edict number four. This is in AD 304. All persons, men, women, and children, were gathered in a public space, and they were forced to offer a collective sacrifice. If they refused, they would be beheaded. And again, many of them, and I shared with you a testimony of one individual who very vehemently called out the Roman officials, "We will not do this." And that's where we ended last week. Finally, in AD 3, not finally, but now subsequently, in AD 305, Diocletian and his fellow Augustus Maximian stepped down from power. That was really remarkable for the day. It was remarkable, first of all, that Diocletian would share rule with anyone. But he did. He divided up into four. He was in the east, and Maximian was in the west. They were the two Augustuses. And the protocol was that they would serve for 20 years and then step down. I mean, imagine being the Roman emperor of half the empire and saying, "We're going to step down after 20 years. And Diocletian did. All right, Diocletian did it. Well, he was old. All right, he was not a young man anymore. So it's, you know. So he stepped down and he made Maximian, who was the Augustus in the West, to do the same thing. And so both of them stepped down. And I believe that protocol was that whoever was the Caesar would then be elevated to be the Augustus then, and a new Caesar would be named under those two people. So when Diocletian stepped down, Galerius, I hope you remember that name, Galerius, strongly anti-Christian, over the East, he became the new Augustus. Over in the West, when Maximius stepped down, Constantius, Constantine's father, stepped in. So now you've got at least one Augustus over here in the West, and probably backwards to you folks over in the West, that was at least tolerant of Christianity. And then you've got Galerius just pushing forward just some of the most horrendous persecution you could imagine in the East. So you had the new emperor Galerius in the eastern provinces. Extremely anti-Christian. Persecution of Christians in the East became even more violent. And the Augustus in the West was Constantius, far more tolerant towards Christians. He's the father of Constantine. Now let's talk a little bit about Constantine. Constantine was by this time very well known. He's a Roman soldier, Roman general, was very victorious in all of his battles. He was, I don't know if he was tall, dark, and handsome, but he was everything you'd look for in a leader, right? In a powerful, strong military leader. But he was over in the East at the time, under Galerius and the armies of that area. But he was very well known for being his military accomplishments. And when Galerius was promoted to be the Augustus, From all intents and purposes, it looked for sure they were going to name Constantine to be the new Caesar in the East. But Galerius looked at Constantine as being far too ambitious, far too smart, had a great deal of military prowess, and so he did not want to elevate Constantine. In fact, he pretty much barred him from being part of that tribunal, the being an Augustus or a Caesar. And so he elevated his nephew. I can't think of Maximian made him the new Caesar in the West. So you had Constantius in the West, and now Maximius over in the West, and then you had Galerius over in the East, and Constantine pushed aside and said, "You're not going to be ruler at all. Galerius felt he could easily manipulate his nephew, right? So he kind of could pull the puppet strings on him. So, and then over in the West, the new Caesar was a man by the name of Severus. That won't mean much to any, we're not going to talk much about Severus. But think of, you know, you had Maximius now and Severus in the West, and you had Galerius and Maximius in the East. I hope I said those names right. I got them down. In AD 306, all right, Constantius dies. All right, this is just a couple of years in, and Constantius dies in the West. And his son, Constantine, had been with him in several battles. The way it worked was that the Augustus and the Caesar in each half of the empire would rule over a certain area. Right? So you had Constantius was ruler over England, right? Britain, what we now would consider France and Spain, that area. And I'm getting the names mixed up, and I don't want to do that. I can't think of the name. I'll get it in a second. But they would rule over various areas of the territory at the same time. So Constantius was up in Britain at the time, fighting and winning battles because Constantine made his way up from the east over to him. And now was fighting with him. And all of his soldiers, all of Constantius' soldiers, just were admiring Constantine at what a great soldier he was, how powerful he was, and what a leader he was. And so when Constantius dies, all of those soldiers, all of those people at the time, they now name Constantine as the new Augustus. Right? So because he's really, really good. Really, really good. So they name him the new Augustus. Well, that is usurpation. And what do you think Galerius thought of that? Right? No, Galerius did not like that at all. Constantine was not in the line of succession, and he technically was barred from the tribunal. They didn't want him at all. So when Galerius got news of the usurpation of Constantine being the new Augustus, he refused to acknowledge Constantine as the senior emperor in the West. He was willing to name him as Caesar. So you can be, and see Galerius, he's the Augustus that's alive now. Even though it's in the East, he's still the Augustus that's alive. Constantius is dead. So he feels himself the one that can control all of this and says, well, Constantine can be Caesar, but not Augustus. All right? Are you following? All right. So he can be a junior leader. And for the time being, Constantine said, okay, I'll take it for time being. And so he became the Caesar, the junior ruler. So Constantine becomes the new Caesar, and then a new man is named as the Augustus. His name is Maxentius. He was the new Augustus. So you had Constantine over in the West, right? He's in Britain, what we now consider Spain, France. And Maxentius is now the ruler over the eastern part of the Western Empire, which would be Rome, right? The Italian peninsula, what we call the Italian peninsula. So so Maxentius is in Rome as the new Augustus would be. Right? And Maxentius was extremely anti-Christian. So again, you've got this fracture within the Western Empire. One emperor, very tolerant of Christianity, and one very not, right? So Constantine was tolerant, just like his father. Maxentius was not. He was anti-Christian. Maxentius was crowned Augustus while Constantine desperately wanted that title. Constantine wanted to be the Augustus, right? But he's settling for Caesar right now. And they both of them wanted more and more control. So war, there are battles, skirmishes everywhere. Finally, Constantine takes his armies and makes his way over to the Italian peninsula. He crosses the Alps and starts taking over cities, winning battle after battle in these cities. And finally, in AD 12, Constantine, after winning a number of these battles, marches against Rome. So now this, you talk about usurpation. Now he is going to be, I'm going to be the emperor, of, at least of the West for right now. So he marches on Rome, and it was on October the 28th, famous date, October 28th, AD 312, that Constantine's armies and Maxentius' armies face off at a place called the Milvian Bridge. If you've heard of Constantine, you've read anything about his life, you kind of know about the Milvian Bridge, right? And the weird thing that military strategists can't figure out is why Maxentius left the protection of the walls of Rome. Because he marched across, not on the Milvian, he actually had some pontoon boats built under a bridge, trying to make his way back and set up his armies outside of Rome. To take, and he had much more army than Constantine had. Can't figure out why he did that, but he did, and it cost him. It cost him the battle. And so now Constantine is marching against these forces. They're trying to make their way back across that bridge. Maxentius ends up dying in that battle. The historians say he drowned in the Tiber River on the outside of Rome. So they say he died there. So here's the story. You know, you've all heard the story. Here's the story. On the night before the battle, right, Constantine, either in a dream or a vision, again, some of these things, I'm gonna explain where we get the information, and some of it gets conflated. So the story is that he saw in the sky a cross of some kind, and he was supposed to have heard these words in Greek, the Greek words en tuto nika, which just means in this conquer, right? And what he saw was, according to his biographers, the historians at the time, that he saw what was what we would call a Christogram in the sky. This was basically the first two letters in the Greek word for the name Christ, right? The first letter for Christ in Greek is the letter chi. Looks like an X to us, right? The second letter in the word for Christ or Christos in Greek is the Greek letter rho, and to us it looks similar to a P. Right? So if you superimpose those over each other, you end up with this, and I'm backwards, it looks like a P with an X across it. You've probably seen that symbol, that Christian symbol, in various places around. That is a Christogram, and this is what Constantine was supposed to have seen that night before the battle. There are a couple of accounts, several accounts, of what took place. Two of the most prominent, two of the most important to us, were by historians who lived pretty much contemporary with Constantine, although they weren't at the battle. So they didn't hear it firsthand. They weren't there as eyewitnesses. They had to hear it secondhand. One of these is a historian by the name of Lactantius. Lactantius was an early Christian writer who actually became an advisor to Constantine. He helped guide Constantine's Christian religious policies in its early stages, and he was actually a tutor over Constantine's son, Crispus. So that's Lactantius. So he's, you know, we talk about a reliable witness, a reliable person to write who knew Constantine, but still he wasn't there. So he's getting this secondhand. He writes a work called On the Death of the Persecutors. This is Lactantius, On the Death of the Persecutors. And he says this in his work, that on that night before the battle, Constantine was commanded in a dream to, quote unquote, delineate the heavenly signs, the sign on the shields of his soldiers, unquote. What he means by that, delineate the Christian sign, was that he was supposed to put that sign on all this, on the shields of all of his soldiers. So the story is that Constantine, whatever, you know, marking he had at the time, marked on those shields that Christogram. And so all those soldiers went into battle with this, that Christian symbol on their shields. That's according to Lactantius. He was commanded to delineate the heavenly sign on the shields of his soldiers. He followed the commands of his dream, and he marked the shields with a sign denoting Christ. And Lactantius describes that sign as a Latin cross with its upper end rounded in a P-like fashion. So I imagine that he's trying to describe this Christogram, or the Chi Rho superimposed on each other. We have another writing, another historical account by a man we all know as Eusebius. We all know Eusebius. Eusebius tells us that he actually inquired of Constantine, and that the account that he presents is from the emperor himself. So the story is that Eusebius, now we're going up a couple of decades. This is later on. This isn't early on. This isn't like a day after it happened. We're going up in Constantine's life and Eusebius's life. And so Constantine is giving this to Eusebius after a couple of decades have gone by of what took place that night. So he'd been ruling now again for almost two decades. So this is from Eusebius. He's a Greek historian of Christianity. He's an exegete. He's a Christian polemicist. So he's what we would consider a reliable witness, right? In about AD 314, he became the bishop of Caesarea Maritima in the Roman province of Syria, right there in Palestine, what we would now call Palestine. And together with another individual by the name of Pamphilus, he was a scholar of the Bible and is regarded as one of the most learned Christians in late antiquity. So he's a highly regarded witness to these things. This is what Eusebius says. Eusebius has two accounts of this event that took place in the life of Constantine. The shorter one is in his work called Ecclesiastical History. In English, we call it Ecclesiastical History. And it fosters the understanding that the Christian God helped Constantine, but does not mention any of the vision. It's just a very short account. God helped Constantine to win this battle. He wrote another book later on, and it's called The Life of Constantine. Eusebius gives in that book a detailed account of a vision, and he emphasizes that he had heard the story from the Emperor Constantine himself. And according to this vision, Constantine, with his army, was marching. Eusebius does not specifically mention where he was marching. Some historians say that this didn't take place on the night before the Milvian Bridge battle, but it took place earlier. So, again, you just have to read the various historical accounts. But Eusebius mentions the dream, but just doesn't say when it took place, just that when he was marching. So it could have been at any time. When it says Constantine and his army were marching, and then all of a sudden he looked up to the sun, and he saw a cross of light above the sun, and with it the Greek words en tuto nika, which I read earlier, usually translated in the Latin. And if you think I'm bad at Greek, I don't do Latin at all. However, and I went online and I you know, you can type in hoc signo, whatever, and how do you pronounce that? And I kid you not, I heard three different pronunciations of this. Okay, so please don't beat me up on my Latin. It's not my language. Okay, so the best I have in Latin, that it said in hoc signo vinces. Okay, which just means in this sign conquer. Same, it's basically the same thing in Greek, but now it's in Latin. All right, and you've probably seen places where they will have Christian symbols in their worship, those words in hoc signo vinces, in this sign conquer under Constantine. Anyway, so through this sign you're going to conquer. Again, we don't really have time to go into all the details. I'm just trying to give you some of it. And I'm really spending extra time on it because Constantine is important. This is an important turning point. Some historians have said that this is the battle that changed the direction of the Western Empire. I mean, just of the entire West. And when you think about Roman paganism had been so dominant for so many years, and now all of a sudden Christianity is introduced, however you look at it, whether you think Constantine's a great guy or a bad guy, or it was good to have a Christian empire, bad to have a Christian empire, how it developed, whatever you think, this was a turning point. I mean, this was a turning point for the West. And so that's why it's important. So again, we can't go into all the details, but what has happened is that we now have a conflated record of those of Eusebius and Lactantius of what took place. So we know that something took place. Something happened. And what happened was very, very important. And the story that Constantine tells later on in his life, he tells to people later on, this is what he said. He says that he saw the risen Christ and that he had converted to Christian faith and that the God of Christianity has granted him success in his battles. So, and again, we'll talk about, was he really a Christian? Did he really turn to Christ or did he not? I'll leave that to you to study, and I'll make some statements about it in our lesson. Maybe we may not get to it tonight, but maybe next week. And so we actually have in our possession, we have archaeological evidence that Constantine did, in fact, use the symbol of the Christogram. We see it in various things. We see it in images of his banner that we find in archaeology. We find it in coins that have been found in these areas with Constantine's image and the Christogram plastered on that as well. So we know that this is true. Whether he saw it in a vision or not, we know that he used that symbol as part of his rule. So at the Battle of Milvian Bridge, Constantine, the new convert to Christianity, is facing off against Maxentius, who is a pagan. So you've got the God of Constantine and the pagan gods of Maxentius really pretty much doing battle there at that bridge. And Constantine supposedly prays to the God of the Christians, and he believed that God had granted him victory. He achieved an overwhelming defeat over Maxentius. And at the young age of 32, Constantine now becomes the ruler of the western portion of the Roman Empire. It was a year later, in AD 313, that Constantine issued what's called the Edict of Milan. He did that with another emperor. We'll talk about him in a minute. But he put out what's called the Edict of Milan. Historians say that it's a weird name because it wasn't really an edict, and he didn't do it from Milan. But it's called the Edict of Milan for some reason. So there you go. That edict didn't necessarily make Christianity the official the religion of the empire. But it placed Christianity among the legal religions of the empire. You had in Rome what they called licit religions. And the person that I studied into this gave me the Latin word. So if you thought my Latin was bad again earlier, I'm not going to try it again. But you had licit religions that were legal. And you had illicit religions. These were just simply religions that were illegal. Christianity was illicit. Now, because of the Edict of Milan, Christianity is now a legal religion. And so it has enjoyed all those freedoms of a legal religion. Constantine does not force Christianity on anyone. So, you know, somebody said, well, he came in and forced everyone to become a Christian. That's just not true. That's a myth. He did not. What we do have is archaeological evidence that pagan religion was still a big part of the Roman Empire and still part of Constantine's life, because we have coins where Constantine is depicted alongside the sun god. So even Constantine himself, in some of these strikings of these coins, you have Constantine and a sun god as well. So there you have that. Many people see these as evidences that Constantine was not really truly a convert, that it was just something he did for some kind of political advantage. I can't imagine what political advantage he would have could have had by naming himself a Christian. I mean, that's a political disadvantage, but some people say that. There's plenty of evidence that portrays Constantine as less than ideal. He's not an ideal Christian, right? And I read, and I got this, and I've got several things down here, several points, but all I could think of was just open your Bible and read some of these Christian leaders, all right? And you're going to find some leaders that are less than godly, all right? They're just not going to be ideal. You're not going to find a perfect person. So look at Constantine. He's not going to be the perfect Christian. And don't look at Constantine and say, well, he was converted overnight just like Paul, so he's going to act like Paul. And he didn't. All right? He still has pagan influences. One thing was he executed many of his political enemies. So there's that. He had his own son Crispus killed in a military coup. His own son. He was known for being particularly fierce and merciless in all of his military campaigns. He was very savage. But look at the 12 sons of Jacob and think of Simeon and the savagery there. Right? In the last years, he was more and more drawn to Arianism. So, and we'll talk about Arianism later because that comes up something that was very important in the church. We'll talk about that, and it was addressed at what we all remember as the Council of Nicaea, which will take place in AD 325. But Arianism came to forefront, which denied, the deity of Christ, the two natures of Christ. And we'll deal with that when we get to that creed. And those are problematic, right? Those are problematic. But does that mean that Constantine didn't live out his Christian faith? In some amount, it was an inconsistency, but did he not live out his Christian faith in some way? My time is gone. Let me just read a quote from Needham. Nick Needham says this about Constantine and our thoughts about him, whether or not he was truly Christian or not. Needham says this, and I quote him, "No doubt, the arguments over Constantine's conversion will continue to rumble on. But the simple fact is, that at a distance of 1,700 years, it is impossible for us to be sure what was really going on in Constantine's heart and mind when he professed the Christian faith. All we can do is look at the effects which this crucial event had on the history of the church." Unquote. So I leave that with you, your own personal convictions. Do your research and do your study, and you come to a conclusion in your own mind about whether or not he was truly Christian. Whether or not he was or not, you cannot doubt this was a crisis point. It was a turning point for the Christian history, the history of the Christian church. All right, let's pray. Our Father and our God, we again thank you for this time together. Please, we pray that you'd bless these thoughts that we have tried to introduce, and that we might look at these and grow in our sanctification, in our edification, in our knowledge of the faith. Bless in our prayer time to follow. We are careful to ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.